I think we haven't gotten this far, have we? Were we on the incomplete dominance? So, okay, and I finished 11 pretty much. So, and remember, 11, incomplete dominance, that was an example of one way in which you have non-Mendelian genetics. So that we're continuing on with other examples of exceptions to Mendelian genetics, or non-Mendelian genetics, as they're all called. This example in slide 12 is actually two examples in one. I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same example, but it serves as... it's an exception to Mendelian genetics for two separate reasons that don't really have anything to do with each other. This uses the human ABO blood group, though, as an example. And there are many, dozens actually, of different, completely unrelated blood groups in humans. But the famous one, well, there's two famous ones, the ABO group and the RH group. And the reason that those are so famous compared to the others is those are the ones that are so clinically important, since you can die if you don't pay attention to what you're doing in transfusions. So the RH group is totally separate from ABO, but when you say someone's blood type, for instance, is AB negative, what that means is it's in the ABO group it's AB, in the RH group it's negative, it's just combining the results of both groups into one. This has nothing to do with RH, this is the ABO group only. And the ABO blood group has to do with producing antigens and antibodies. Antibodies are proteins that are found in the plasma of the blood. There's two major components to the blood. The whole blood is a tissue, connective tissue, and there's two major parts to it. Cells, the blood cells themselves, the vast majority of which are red blood cells, shown here, and all the non-cellular liquid that's outside of the cells but still part of the blood, that's collectively called the plasma. And that's where you find all kinds of different things, including proteins that act for immunity, and those are called antibodies. Antibodies have a particular shape that's able to recognize a particular shape of something that is foreign in the body. And that's why it serves for immunity. It surveils the body for invading organisms that might do you harm and takes actions to prevent you from getting sick from that. That's what vaccines are based on. It causes the body to produce specific antibodies that will recognize specific antigens. Well, antigens are usually foreign material. But there's antigens that are produced on blood cells, red blood cells, of humans, and the antigen types, which are represented by the yellow pieces of these red blood cells on the surface, are produced according to a gene. Now, the first reason that this is an exception to Mendelian genetics, or the name of the exception that this is an example of, is multiple alleles. But multiple here doesn't mean two or more like it does in everyday language. Multiple means three or more. Because remember what the assumption, the two major assumptions of Mendelian genetics are, that whatever gene you're looking at there in the population, there's exactly two alleles. Well, multiple alleles means more than two. And in this case, it's three, as you can see. In the population of humans, there's three different alleles, which are the I gene, versions of the I gene, and I here stands for immunoglobulin, which means antibody. But there's the A version, the B version, and the O version, which is just symbolized as a lowercase I with no superscript. Three possibilities. Now, any given human is diploid, of course, so any given human is going to have two alleles as normal, but there's three possibilities in the population, and that makes things different compared to how they work with Mendelian genetics. In other words, you're not going to get the familiar ratios that we talked about. But the gene determines what kind of antigens, the yellow things, that are put onto the blood cells, and correspondingly what kind of antibodies are produced in the plasma. So a person can be a type A in two different ways. Because A is dominant over O, so it only takes one A to be a type A, one A allele. You can be AA, which is what I super A means, or AO. Either one of those is going to give you A antigens that you produce on your blood cells. But the antibodies that are in the plasma better not be type A, right? Anti-A type. The antibodies that a type A blood person makes are anti-B. In other words, the antibodies need to recognize B as foreign blood. And exactly the opposite for a type B person. Type B person makes B antigens on the blood cells and anti-A antibodies in the plasma. And a type O person, a type AB person is one of each alleles. So they produce both kinds of antigens and therefore don't produce either kind of antibody, because either kind of antibody would recognize that blood as foreign and it would attack its own blood. The only way, because of dominance, that you can be type O is to have both of your alleles be the O type, just the lowercase I symbol. And those don't produce any antigens on the blood cells, and they therefore have both kinds of antibodies in the plasma. They'll recognize any of these other as foreign blood. Okay, so that's one exception, multiple alleles. That's an exception by itself. But this same example, same blood group, illustrates a different example that's called codominance, which is different from incomplete dominance. So be careful with the words. We've already been through incomplete dominance. That was the pink flower one. Co means share. So there is still a dominance relationship here, but codominance means there's two different alleles that simultaneously dominate. All right. In this case, O is recessive. In other words, A is dominant over O, and B is also dominant over O. And specifically, what codominance indicates is that if you have an individual who is heterozygous and has one of each of these codominant alleles, that would be the type AB person, they're not, there's neither of them dominates over the other, and therefore the heterozygous individual has both traits at the same time. And specifically in this example, what that means is that a type AB person is just as much a type A person as a fully type A person, and at the same time is just as much a type B person as a fully type B person. All right, so it's not that one dominates over the other. They both shine through independently. Now, just call this next slide 12 and a half because I don't actually have a slide for it, a picture to illustrate it. But let me go to the next exception to Mendelian genetics, and that is called pleiotropy. Up to now, all of our examples for genetics that we've used in these slideshows have involved the situation in which one gene corresponds to one characteristic, right? Like flower color. The flower color gene controls flower color, and that's it. In pleiotropy, you have the situation in which one gene controls more than one characteristic. And so it's kind of like a divergence, meaning one thing splits into two. One gene simultaneously controls at least two, maybe more, characteristics. Now, I don't have a picture for you, but we've actually looked at a picture of the example that I'll talk about, which is the sickle cell disease in humans. I talked about that when I showed it to you originally, I was talking about it in terms of mutation, which is involved, of course. Mutation is how you have multiple alleles possible in the population. Without mutation, you wouldn't have different versions of genes. But the reason that sickle cell is an example of pleiotropy is also the reason why it still exists, that allele, that mutant allele, which gives you the defective hemoglobin. It's why it still exists in human populations. If you think about how natural selection works, you would predict that natural selection would phase it out, right? Because it's a big deal. It's a serious illness to have sickle cell disease. Therefore, you would think natural selection would disfavor that allele. Any individuals having it would have a much reduced chance of surviving to the point of passing it on to the next generation. So you'd think over time, it would be phased out, right? And that's true if it were entirely bad. But really, there is in humans what is or in this gene, the hemoglobin gene, what is called the heterozygote advantage. Meaning that the heterozygous individual has an advantage over the homozygous dominant and the homozygous recessive individual. Normal is dominant over mutant hemoglobin. A fully normal person, of course, doesn't have sickle cell disease and doesn't even have the allele that can cause it. It's completely normal with respect to the hemoglobin he produces, or she. A homozygous recessive individual has both versions of the gene. Both alleles are the defective version. And that's what gives them the disorder, which is bad news. A heterozygous individual has one normal hemoglobin allele and one abnormal one. That's the heterozygote. Well, having that one normal allele is enough to keep that person from actually having sickle cell disease. The person is a carrier, but doesn't have it. The actual disease just is able to pass on the allele. But in addition to not having it, which is like the fully normal person, the heterozygous individual, that one defective version, actually gives that heterozygous individual a greater resistance to malaria than a fully normal person does. So it not only allows you not to have the disorder, but it also gives you increased resistance to malaria. And in places where malaria is a big deal that kills millions of people, that's a huge advantage. And that's why natural selection favors it for being in the population, because the heterozygous individuals do the best, and they're always going to pass on one defective allele to the next generation. But anyway, back to why this is an example of pleiotropy. I said pleiotropy is one gene simultaneously controlling multiple characteristics. Well, this gene controls the characteristic of normal versus abnormal hemoglobin, and it also controls the characteristic of malarial resistance. Two different characteristics simultaneously be controlled by one gene. So that was 12 and a half, so to speak. Now we can go back to pictures in slide 13. And this next example, I said pleiotropy was kind of like a divergence, one gene, multiple characteristics. The next one is just the opposite. It's kind of like a convergence, multiple genes, one characteristic. And that's called epistasis. So look at these rats in slide 13. How many characteristics are we talking about here? Are we looking at? Just coat color, so one characteristic. But look at the genotypes. How many genes are involved? Two. There's the B gene and the C gene. That's why the diploids have four overall characters, two Bs and two Gs, diploid in B and diploid in C. That's why it's epistasis. Epistasis is a specific kind of gene interaction. Think back to when we were talking about transcription in eukaryotes. Remember that for transcription, for a gene to be turned on, in other words, in order for it to be transcribed, RNA polymerase needs to see that promoter, the very beginning of the gene, and bind there, right? But remember that I said in eukaryotes, it's often the case that RNA polymerase by itself is not able to bind to the promoter. First, you have to have what were sphere-looking things in the slide at the time, which are proteins, bind there first. You remember what the proteins are called? That the spherical cartoons represented? That had to be there before RNA polymerase could come along and bind as well. Those were called transcription factors. Transcription factors, like factors in general, are proteins. Where do proteins come from? Right, you have to have instructions for how to build proteins. So the transcription factors, which are proteins necessary for other genes to be turned on, are themselves the products of their own genes. So you have one gene producing proteins that can affect whether a second gene gets turned on or off. That's why it's epistasis. So the B gene here is the gene that actually determines what color of pigment that individual can produce. And B here actually stands for black, even though brown also starts with B. Black is dominant over brown, so lowercase b means brown. But the C gene determines whether any pigment gets made, because the C gene is the gene that makes the transcription factor that allows the B gene to get turned on. In other words, if you don't have C gene producing the correct transcription factors, which requires an uppercase C, the dominant form, then it doesn't matter what kind of B alleles you have, that gene is going to stay off, because it can't be turned on if you don't have the right transcription factors. And this should make sense when you look at the Punnett square. So if you don't have at least one uppercase C, then you don't make the transcription factor, and the B gene will stay off, which means no coloration will be produced, and that will result in white fur. Notice that all four of these have both C's lowercase. All the rest of them have at least one uppercase C, which means they make the transcription factors that will turn on the B gene. So if you have at least one uppercase C, then you look at the B's to see whether it's going to be black or brown. And if there's at least one uppercase B, that'll be black. Otherwise, it'll be a brown. And it's kind of like a convergence, because you have two genes simultaneously affecting one characteristic. All right. 14. This next exception represented here is called polygenic inheritance. So what does that word polygenic mean? Just as if you look at it as a word, what do you expect that to mean? Multiple genes, exactly. Polygenic inheritance is the situation in which several different genes all contribute a little bit to one overall phenotype. So they all affect the same characteristic, but they do so by contributing some to the total. The example, specific example here for polygenic inheritance is skin color in humans. And skin color in humans is affected by a couple. It's the actual skin color is not only because of pigment, which is what the genes are about, but it's also about blood. I mean, first of all, we say all the time black and white. There's no such thing as a white person. There's no such thing as a black person. There's only people that are somewhere in a continuum or a continuous range between two extremes, very light or very dark. But the actual color is partly genetic, because it's due to melanin, the pigment that's produced. That's the brownishness. But also, we're not really brown, we're brownish red, because the redness is the blood cells showing through the skin. And the less melanin that's there, the lighter the overall shade. So each box here represents a different possible combination here. These little circles within the box represent genes. And so I don't know that it specifically is six genes for human skin coloration, but that's what that would indicate. And then whether it's a black or a white circle indicates which type of allele, whether or not melanin is going to be laid down. And the more black circles you have, the more melanin gets laid down in the skin cells, which makes them darker. That's polygenic inheritance. So it results there, unlike other cases where you just have one gene controlling the characteristic, is that instead of having two traits, like purple flowers or white flowers and no other possibilities, you have a range, you have a continuum of traits, any along which you can be any value. 15. Actually, we're looking at some hydrangea flowers here. And obviously, if you're not colorblind, you can tell that there are traits differ, right? One's pink, one's purple, one's blue, or whatever. But you can tell they're the same species, right? Pretty much identical otherwise. Based on what you've learned up to this point, it would be reasonable to say, well, it's easy to explain how these can be different flower types. We've looked at this in pea plants, right? You can say, well, they have different alleles for flower color. A reasonable assumption. But actually, that's not what's happening here. These are actually genetically identical individuals. So how could you have genetically identical individuals have different traits?
You read about this. It's pulling different things from the soil quality.
That's right.
Impacts how these are...
So if you generalize that from this plant example to all species, what would you say is different here?
Impacted by the environment.
Exactly. Phenotype certainly has a genetic component. That's what we've been talking about all along, right? In other words, the actual allele or alleles that you have affect your phenotype. But phenotype, importantly, also has an environmental component. And in this case, the soil pH, I think, was different. And therefore, that resulted in different traits. And if you think about humans, imagine identical twins, which, remember, happens by accident. We're supposed to be one zygote split into two. They're genetically identical at that point, but they develop as individuals, separate individuals. Well, if you separate them at birth and they live 80 years in different parts of the world doing different things, they're no longer going to be identical, right? Because of the different environmental effects of phenotype. Or even if they live alone, I mean, they live together for their whole life, and one decides to be a bodybuilder and the other one doesn't, they're not going to look the same. So there definitely is an environmental component to phenotype. 16 shows you some family trees in humans, which are called pedigrees. And this is showing you what would be called pedigree analysis. If you think back to when I was talking about test crosses, which are used in order to figure out what the genotypes are of some individuals that you don't know, well, you can go ahead with crosses to figure that out if you have the right kind of organisms, like the plants we talked about. But it's not ethical to do that in humans. You don't breed humans just for the sake of figuring out what their gene is, right? And even if it were ethical, imagine how long it would take to get an F2, right? At least 15 years if you breed them at 15. But we don't do that with humans. Instead, Well, this is actually kind of an old-fashioned notion now, the pedigree analysis. But before we had the ability, which is only fairly recently, to so easily look directly at someone's DNA, we would have to use deductive reasoning to figure it out based on dominance and recessive traits. In other words, for instance, if a person has a recessive trait, that means they have to be homozygous recessive, right? Which means that one of their parents has to, I mean, both of their parents has to have to have at least one recessive allele, because they both gave that offspring a recessive allele. And therefore, if both parents are dominant in their trait, for instance, that means they both have to be heterozygous. You understand the reasoning there? That's what pedigree analysis is all about. But it's much easier nowadays just to get DNA tested. And speaking of DNA testing, slide 17 is about that as well. In this case, there's two separate tests shown here that are examples of DNA testing prenatally. Test the fetus to see whether there is evidence of a genetic disorder that can't be survived, for instance. The big difference here, they're both collection of DNA methods, but they just are occurring at different times in the term. Amniocentesis is done later. This is the one on the left, so it actually is later in the pregnancy. In this case, the uterus is punctured, and a sample of the fluid, the amniotic fluid that surrounds the fetus is swimming in before birth. Some of the DNA from the fetus sloughs off and gets put into that liquid, so you can easily get a sample from the liquid without actually having to stab the fetus, and you simply do DNA testing on that. The one on the right is actually done earlier in the pregnancy, which is why this is very early fetus, right after the embryonic stage. That's called chorionic villus sampling. Villus, like the microvilli of the gut. Oh, I talked about a villus is a finger-like projection. Well, in this case, it's a villus of the placenta, specifically the chorion, which is where chorionic comes from. So you're able to just put a tube in, use air suction to get a sample of the chorionic villi from the placenta, which, and placenta is an interesting thing because it's simultaneously an organ of the mother and of the child. And that's where they come together as far as transfer of nutrients and transfer of waste is concerned. But anyway, you get the DNA from the chorionic villi and you can run tests the same way. I think that's it, because 18 and 19 make up one big summary table, and I've already talked about all these examples, including, I think, yeah, there's even a pleiotropy example we talked about. So we're done with that chapter.